Hey, welcome to Better Than Yesterday. Oshie here. You might hear an ad right here. If this is your first episode, hi, thanks for coming, but I have to play ads to help me pay the team that helps me make the show. So if you hear an ad, thank you. You're helping us keep the lights on. If you don't, well, ripper, you're going to get straight to Michael saying something cool.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Animal agriculture is responsible for 14.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions. 38.5% of the world's habitable landmass is devoted to animal agriculture. Animals are an incredibly inefficient way to produce food. You know, the average cow needs to eat 12 kilograms of plants to produce 1 kilogram of beef. For a pig, it's 8 to 1. For a chicken, it's 4 to 1. And so 80% of the crops that we grow around the world aren't eaten by humans. They're eaten by animals, which humans then eat. And we only get 18% of our calories from animals. So it's an incredibly inefficient way to produce food. And so if we switch to just eating those plants directly, we could reforest 38.5% of the world's habitable landmass. And not only would that completely, it would eliminate the 14.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions, but we could capture huge amounts of the carbon that we've emitted back in forests and rehabitat all of that land.
That is the co-founder and CEO of Fable Food Company, Michael Fox. And this is Better Than Yesterday. Hello and welcome to Better Than Yesterday. I'm Oshie Ginsberg. Thank you so much for being here. Welcome. Grateful you're a part of the show. This is a bi-weekly podcast where twice a week I hope to help you make today just a little bit better than yesterday. Something you hear on this show is guaranteed to help you make today better than yesterday. That's what we're here to do. Been here since 2013. Every Monday I'm here with a guest. Every Friday I'm here with you. And thanks for coming, basically. If you don't know who I am, I'm a TV guy. Reality TV, big shiny floor TV, and now documentary TV. I've also written a book, and I like to ride bikes and motorbikes, and I'm into electric cars, and yeah, there's a lot about me, but we'll get to that later. Thanks heaps for everyone that sent lovely, lovely messages about the documentary that came out on SBS last week. You can find it in SBS On Demand. Just look for Australia Uncovered. And we're the second documentary in that series, Australia Uncovered. The show is called A Matter of Life and Death. And thank you very much for all the wonderful, wonderful feedback, particularly on email, send.heremail@gmail.com, and also on Instagram. It's very, very nice to hear from you. So thank you heaps. And please let people who you think might need to see the show, please let them know where they can see it. I really hope a lot of people that need to see it get to see it, particularly those in policy. I think that'd be great. Today's episode is a real goodie, and I'm stoked, so stoked to have this guy on. Michael Fox is the co-founder and CEO of Fable Food Company, which is a company that create a product called Fable. What is that? It is an all-natural plant-based meat, and they make it out of shiitake mushrooms. Now, full disclosure, I don't know if you've never listened to the show before, I've been plant-based for nearly 20 years, like 19 and a half years, and vegetarian for about 25, for like 5 years before that, right? We've been eating this stuff, this Fable stuff, for over a year at our place, and they didn't know that. When they asked me if he could come on the podcast, they had no idea that I loved it. So when they said, "You want him on the show?" I'm like, "Yeah, that stuff's delicious. I love it. It's really, really yummy." Michael is a fascinating cat himself. He's an entrepreneur. He's a formerly meat-loving Queenslander, which I can relate to. He turned vegetarian 6 years ago. We talk all about that. And I guess he was looking to combine his cravings for meat with his healthier and healthy home cooking habits. And then that led him to create this. It's a whole food-based, minimally processed plant-based meat. Now, when it comes to these things, and we talk about this in this conversation, what you put in your mouth is completely your business, I promise you, all right? But I already know it's important, and you already know that it's important to you how your choices impact the world around you. And I feel it's important that we all know how we choose to feed ourselves and our families impacts the world around us. Like, how sustainable is what we put on the table? That's an important question to ask. It's a tricky one, because stone fruit in winter is nice, but it's important. Is the way we're eating leading towards enough food and water for everyone, or away from that? There's a few tough questions you might think about as we go through this conversation, certainly as we start to speak about climate impacts of the meat industry, which are not insignificant, let alone the ethical impacts, but that's a different threshold for some people to cover. The thing is, you've probably already made a number of choices in your life to minimize your impact. You're probably already aware of your impact, and you've probably made a lot of choices already. Like, you've probably bought a more fuel-efficient vehicle, whether you did it so deliberately or not. The latest car you've driven is the most efficient car you've ever driven. You probably recycle your soft plastics. You definitely separate your recycling. You probably have tried to buy or look out to buy products made from sustainable materials or recycled partially or wholly recycled materials. You've probably already made a number of really simple choices around the way you consume to minimize your impact. The conversation about food, though, it's a very personal one, and Michael and I talk a lot about that, about the emotion involved. And this chat will probably give you something to think about. There's plenty of resources at the other end of this chat. If you had to think about things, and there's plenty of resources. Don't worry, you won't be alone. But you can find out what they're all about at fablefood.co. That's fablefood.co. And I really hope you enjoy this conversation, because he's a cracking guy. This is Michael Fox. Welcome to Sydney Lockdown. Where in the world are you?
Sunshine Coast for me.
Oh, man.
We've been pretty fortunate up here. Yeah.
Which part of the Sunny Coast you at?
My wife and I bought a 41-acre property in Palmwoods.
Fuck
just
yeah.
Kind of half an hour in from Mooloolaba.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, you did. And I'm very happy to hear that. I spent a bit of time in that area.
Oh, have you?
Well, yeah, I went to Udalo for the Chenrezig, the Buddhist retreat up there. I went there for a while.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Cool.
It's a pretty special place.
Yeah. We're like 5 minutes from Udalo. Yeah,
it's such a
beautiful part of the world.
Astonishing, astonishing part of the world.
Yeah. We've got some friends who live on the property with us, and they did a 10-day silent meditation retreat at that Buddhist temple recently.
Yeah, that's the one I did. It was back in 98. But that was really transformative in my own journey. I was 24, and I'd already been toying with not eating meat. I'd already been like kind of trying to eat less meat.
Yeah.
It was an environmental thing for me, and then it was an ethical thing, and then it was eventually became a health thing once I realized how much better I felt. But I just, I didn't know how to prepare, didn't know how to make the food. And then I went to Chenrezig, which is down the road from you, and ate proper Buddhist chef cruelty-free food.
Amazing.
For like a week and a bit or something. And I was like, this is incredible. I feel nourished. I feel full. I feel incredible. I feel great. Ah, this can be done. And that was a real, that was a real turning point in my journey.
So good to hear.
Well, we all kind of just need that moment, which I know is a big part of how you got Fable up and running. You sort of identified that, a lot of people
You know what? We've just put a trampoline in for our youngest 2 years old. I don't know. We have a trampoline in the backyard, and there's a ladder for the trampoline, but you can take the ladder away so we can't get into it. So people go, I want to jump on the trampoline, but there's no ladder. You know, so people are, I want to not eat meat, but I don't know how to get up to that part. And you just have to give them the steps, you know. You have to go, here it is, and then boom, they're in. Did you grow up in Queensland?
Yeah, actually my dad was a mining engineer, so kind of grew up in mining towns, but mostly Queensland, a bit in the Northern Territory, a bit in regional New South Wales. And then from when I was 15, we moved to Brisbane. So I kind of finished high school, university, started working in Brisbane. Yeah, so Queensland's home.
What mining towns like, I'm guessing like you watch your Mount Isa and up there and inland from Mackay and stuff?
Yeah, well, I was born in Broken Hill in New South Wales, and where kind of BHP gets its name from. Then Moranbah up near Mackay in North Queensland. Probably the most exciting place was Groote Eylandt, this little island in the Gulf of Carpentaria up in the Northern Territory. That was spectacular. It's like 1,500 kind of people of European descent, 1,500 Aboriginal people living on the island. What was I? I was like 8, 9, 10 years old. That's sort of 3.5 years we lived there, that age. And it was just the best, like, you know, going out on with my mates out on our bikes out into the bush and climbing trees. And, you know, you didn't have to worry, you had to worry about crocodiles. You wouldn't want to go swim in any creeks. But other than crocodiles, you were kind of free to roam around and, yeah, no sort of dangers or anything. It was awesome. Just loved it. And I think my love of, yeah, kind of the bush and nature probably stemmed from those few years. Yeah.
We are all very much rooted. There is no love greater than the love of food, is the famous quote. We're all rooted very much in trying to reconnect with times around the table with people we cared about through meals that, oh, this reminds me of something my grandma made, or this reminds me of something my dad used to make. What kind of cuisine was going on for the formative parts of your life?
Very much the traditional kind of Queensland steak for dinner 2 or 3 times a week, beef mince for dinner pretty much every night. When we were being healthy, we were having chicken, and that was maybe once or twice a week. And then lunch, you know, meat every day, like ham sandwiches. And my mum did the best she could for making those things healthy. But yeah, we were massive meat eaters. And yeah, I grew up eating, very much eating beef.
Well, it's very Queensland. There's heaps of cows up there.
there are a lot.
Yeah, which is wild because, you know, I watched Survivor. I'm pretty sure they filmed it on a cattle property out in Cloncurry. Like, fuck, the cows get to live here? Holy shit.
They've got a good life.
It's pretty amazing. What was it like for you when you came after, you know, literally living in the bush and being in contact with First Nations people and seeing very traditional ways of life and things like that? As you moved into the kind of more cosmopolitan, metropolitan areas of the state, particularly when you started getting among the sandstone of UQ, what was that like to you? Do you think it gave you a different perspective on the way people carry themselves?
That's a really good question. I mean, it exposed me to lots of other different people who I might not have met along the way. University was a great experience for being exposed to lots of different ideas. Yeah, I think universities are a breeding ground for you. You get people on you meet your first kind of activists on the left, meet activists on the right, and you see the whole sort of full political spectrum. And yeah, it was kind of exciting getting exposed to all these new and different ideas. Yeah, and then doing things like going backpacking on holidays overseas, you get exposed to all of that. A bit of a rite of passage for many Australians. Unfortunately, not the last few years, but yeah, so getting exposure to all those ideas was awesome.
You talk about the political scene at university. It can be quite confronting. I knew a couple of kids that their dads were in the Liberals, and they were in Young Liberals and Young Labor, and they would get into fights at lunchtime. I'd be like, what are they yelling about? I didn't understand what the fuck was going on. Yeah. My only exposure to it was when I was in bands in Brisbane, and I would go around to the UQ campus and put posters up, and we'd often be postering over international socialists and all kinds of like huge political protests and stuff like that. You ended up being the president of the Queensland Law Society at UQ. Like early on, that must have been like a hectic, turbulent amount of opinion and, you know, ideas and ideologies coming at you.
Well, to be honest, despite the name, it wasn't so much a kind of political or even legal organization. It was one of those party social clubs at uni. So I kind of got into that through organizing the law ball each year, which was like the big part, you know, 1,000 law students going out, big sort of annual party. I did that for a couple of years and then kind of got elected president, but more on my platform of more parties, more fun than anything else.
So you were Van Wilder.
Yeah, maybe not quite that extreme or that good at it, but yeah, more that angle than the traditional sort of legal path.
But that did paint the picture, I guess, for what you do now, which is sell alternative meat products into retail, because you're rubbing up against people who sell booze and food for a living, and you were trying to convince them to give the members of your law society, you know, cheaper beers and cheaper meals, right?
Yeah, I did. I met a lot of awesome people in the food industry, and it definitely exposed me to that. I think it also exposed me to kind of entrepreneurship. So back then, and I think it still exists now, the University of Queensland Law Society, exactly like you touched on, puts together kind of a discount card each year with discounts to all the pubs and clubs and restaurants, and then sells that card to students. So I think the year I was president, the card sold for $10 and we sold 10,000 of those cards. So we kind of, $100,000 in cash in the bank at the start of the year, and that made for some really good parties. So, putting that card together and selling it to students in O-Week, that was, I think, my first big exposure to entrepreneurship, and, I loved it.
So your dad's a mining engineer. You don't go anywhere near engineering. Don't worry, both my parents were doctors and I'm two of four boys. None of us went anywhere near medicine. But you're the president of the Law Society. Obviously, next step, mate, in you go. Law firm, partner, off we go. Boat, that sort of thing, it's all there. It's all in the future. Did you go down that path?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really pay attention to what I should do work-wise after university. So, I was busy organising the social events and the L card. And, I went to the career days and I studied commerce and law, and, the people who came to talk to the commerce law students were the investment banks, the accounting firms and the law firms. I think in my second last year, I did an internship in an accounting firm and didn't like that. Then in my final year, I did an internship in an investment bank. I didn't like that. So I kind of got to the end and I was like, oh, well, it's really only law left. I'll go get a job at a law firm. And went and got a job at Clayton Utz, one of the big commercial law firms. And law didn't suit me and I didn't suit law. It wasn't a happy marriage.
Tell me about that. Tell me, what's it like to go to university for years and years and years studying this thing and land a gig at like a massive law firm where there's a clear path to the country club membership, the cruiser boat, anchored down at Sanctuary Cove. It's all like, it's all in your future. It's all there. What's it like to get there and go to work one day and go, oh, I don't like this?
I mean, it was pretty clear for me, like 2 months in, I had my office with a view of, the Brisbane River, go in your suit and tie every day. And all the lawyers would kind of, go into their office and shut their doors and work away on whatever project it was they were working on. And I'd leave my door wide open and people would walk past my office and I'd be like, oh, hey, Caroline, come in and say hi as they kind of walk past. Like, depending on what type of law you do, suits different people. But I was at a big commercial law firm. It suits kind of introverts and people who like to kind of focus on a meaty problem and work on that. And I'm not that person at all. I'm a little introverted sometimes, but I lean more towards extroversion. And so it was a pretty clear thing for me, within 2 months that this wasn't going to suit me long term. So then I had to go and spend some time actually thinking about what I did want to do, which it's not something I'd done until that point.
Well, that's okay. I mean, did you talk to your folks about it? Did you let them know, hey, all those, those hex fees and all that kind of stuff, don't think I'm going to use it?
Yeah, well, I think they were probably a little clever about it all. Like, a commerce law degree is applicable in lots of different places. So it was good that I think if you'd gone and done dentistry and didn't like being a dentist, that you're kind of a little bit boxed in there. But with something like commerce law, it's pretty broad. So yeah, they were fine with me going out and exploring what it was I wanted to do. And Dad was a mining engineer and had worked his way up into kind of management roles. So I then started to pay a bit of attention to what he was doing and thought, okay, well, maybe this kind of business management type path might be something that would interest me.
Where did you go?
So I then went and did a graduate program at Super Retail Group. So they own Super Cheap Auto, BCF. So into retail, and I loved it.
So you come out of law and then Now you're in retail, you're customer facing. What was it about that ticked your clock?
I love that there were so many different interesting aspects of that business, like starting with the customer, like your consumer research to understand what it is that the customer wants to buy. Then, okay, well, what products are going to fulfill those needs? How do we put a range together in a store that you know has a story and a reason for the customer to come into the store? How do you market those products to customers? And then how do you source those products? So a lot of those products, you know, come out of China. So sourcing in Asia and the whole sort of international element to it. Supply chain, how do you get all that logistics being efficient?
Right.
I really fell in love with retail and particularly the sort of consumer psychology and understanding the customer. All of that stuff was really interesting.
From there, you went to Google. So you're combining this law background that you've got with this retail knowledge now. And now you're into the tech space where, as far as the customer is concerned, we're still on black and white TV. And when you're in at Google and you're reading the internal documents, you're like, here's what's coming. Like, you know, you can see 5G 12 years ago. What did that open your eyes to when you worked at Google?
Yeah, I mean, that really exposed me, I guess, to the kind of tech startup space and, yeah, technology more broadly, and just being able to see these big trends that were coming in and sort of get a bit of a sense for trying to look into the future. I mean, so much of what Google was doing back then and I'm sure still is now was, yeah, trying to predict, you know, what does the world look like in 5, 10, 20 years, and how do we build the technology products that help people to get access to the right information in that world. So, yeah, it really exposed me to all of that, which I fell in love with.
So how did you get from, there was a shoe company in the middle there, which was building custom shoes for people. You raised a humongous amount of money for that.
Yeah.
You had 200 employees, you were in America, it was valued at tens of millions of dollars, and you're still young, man. You're not even 40 right now. So you were not even 30 at the time. What's it like when something you've built so big doesn't work?
Yeah, it was tough. Yeah. We had done well in this niche of women who were very passionate about designing their own shoes. You know, we tried to cross the chasm into the mainstream sort of fashion market and allowing the mainstream fashion consumer to design their own shoes. And yeah, the value proposition that we built just didn't resonate. And yeah, I mean, it was tough. Like you said, we'd raised a lot of money from investors, some really good investors who we valued those relationships, and you know, we ultimately ended up having to close the business down and sell the assets. So we weren't able to return the capital to those investors. We had 200 employees, laying off 200 employees. It was like ripping a Band-Aid off slowly. You know, it was kind of like probably 6-9 months that we had to kind of lay people off because we were trying to sort of pivot the business and adjust our cost structure and see if we could make it work. As you touched on, we moved our headquarters to Los Angeles. So we had sort of 25 Australians with us in LA who'd moved to the other side of the world with the business. They were all close friends, and having to lay them off. Yeah, it was not a pleasant experience, not something I would wish for anyone to have to go through. No.
What did you take away from it? What did you learn from that?
One of the big things I think was, yeah, kind of resilience, like how to working through a situation like that. And there are probably a few things that helped me through that. My first child, my son, was born kind of in the middle of all of that, closing the business down, and he was healthy and great. So, you know, I spent a lot of time in that period reflecting on, okay, you know, this sucks going to work every day at the moment and doing all these things, but, you know, my wife's healthy, my son's healthy, you know, that's kind of orders of magnitude more important in life. I'm laying people off. These people are dying, and we're all doing our best to, you know, help them find other jobs and get their visas sorted out and all of those things. So I tried to reflect on the positive things and, yeah, look to the positives in life through all of that. And it was tough, but the reality is there's much worse things that people have to go through than what I did through that.
Not all of us are going to be able to have a conversation where we need to call up an investor who's given us a couple of million dollars and say, mate, I can't give you the money back. Not all of us are going to have to lay off one person, let alone 200. What words of advice would you have to tell us about having uncomfortable conversations like that?
Yeah, good question. I guess being honest and transparent kind of the whole way through helped a lot. So, you know, we shared, okay, here's our strategy. We're going to move from this niche into this mainstream part of the fashion market. Here's all the consumer research that we've done and why we think that's going to work. So the investors were on board with that, and they'd invested based on that strategy. And then we were, you know, showed them, hey, look, here's the data and why it's not working. Here's where we're pivoting and trying to adjust the business and take a different approach. And they're on board with all of that. So we were very open and honest and transparent with them all the way through. And it was, yeah, it was just it was the failing in our consumer research, which led to us having an incorrect strategy. So those investors kind of, when they invest in a business, particularly venture capital investors, their whole business model is that a small percentage of their businesses they invest in will do incredibly well and lots will fail. So we also had investors on who, you know, could afford to lose the money and were in it for the big gain and knew that there was a big risk. So having the right investors on was helpful. And then, yeah, actually calling them up and having that conversation. Actually, you had Mike Cannon Brooks on, and he was one of our investors in Shoes Appraise, an investor in Fable as well. And I had literally had one of that exact conversation. I remember having with him, calling him up and letting him know, hey, that the strategy hasn't worked and we're going to sell the assets, but we're not going to be able to return your capital. And the first words out of his mouth were, you know, how are you? How are the team? Which was, I found, just extraordinary. And I think also it was the fact we had really good people on board as investors also, you know, made those conversations easier. People who were empathetic to the situation and thought like that was just super helpful.
Talking with Mike, I mean, crikey, you'd be grateful to have Mike as an investor because I don't think they all sound like that. When, hey, remember those millions of bucks you wanted? They're gone.
And to be fair, not all the conversations were as easy as the one with
him.
But they were literally no one who was kind of angry about it. They all were on the journey. They all got it.
So we were living in Los Angeles around about the same time, and I'd been plant-based since the late 90s. And I remember moving to Los Angeles going, oh my God, there's a whole aisle of tofu. Like, I could not believe the availability of meat alternatives. How did the journey away from meat start for you? Where did the first kind of seeds drop? Where did you get incepted? Where did Leo DiCaprio jump into your dreams and tell you?
Yeah, I think it probably happened about 15 years ago. And I don't even remember the specifics. I just remember reading some articles, reading some books and just different things that just made me start to question our kind of food system. And, you know, the average Australian eats 122 kilograms of land animals every year. I ate a lot more than that. I was a big meat eater. And so I'd started to read some of those things and it had just made me start to question it. So I was reducing my meat consumption. I probably hadn't had the full conscious thought that I should go fully vegetarian and then vegan. But so it's probably 10 years from having the first kind of initial vague semi-conscious thoughts of reducing my meat consumption. And then I started to, I caught up with some friends who'd gone vegetarian and vegan and had some conversations with them. And then I read a couple of books by Peter Singer, Animal Liberation, and then read another book, Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer. And yeah, basically as soon as I put that, I remember putting down the book Eating Animals and that tipped me over to be vegetarian. And that was 6 years ago now.
It is profound once you have that, oh, all right, okay, well, I don't want to do that anymore. But then you're like, well, what do I do now? Do I just eat salad? Like, what happens? Then comes the rebuilding your shopping list and rebuilding your fridge. What was that like for you?
Yeah, well, like you said, it was fortunate that I was living in LA. You know, this was 6 years ago. I think Australia is even now ahead of where LA was at the time. But yeah, a lot of vegan restaurants in LA, and yeah, like you say, the supermarkets, particularly in sort of around Venice Beach and Santa Monica, where we're living, there's lots of plant-based products. So, I mean, it was still a tough journey. You know, like I had my beef mince tacos that I, you know, cooked every second week, my spaghetti bolognese, and, you know, all of those dishes that I love to make. So I had to go and find alternatives. But the great thing was there were really good plant-based alternatives for those foods, which made the transition easier. You know, some textured soy protein-based mince in the supermarkets, and that I could literally just swap out the recipes. And then, so that got me over the initial hump. And then I got, as I'm sure you have too, got more creative with what I was cooking and started to use things like tofu and chickpeas and mushrooms, and actually ended up with a whole completely different repertoire of dishes that I cook at home. And yeah, it's been great.
Once you have that transitional phase, I remember like initially getting things like fake bacon and stuff like that. And then after all, I'm like, that's not really into it. But I understood straight away. I was like, oh, people need this. They need this thing. Is that what you saw when you started thinking about, look, there's an opportunity here. People are moving. I'm using my Google brain to think of trends in the next 10, 20 years. Like, people need that ladder to get from here, where they eat meat all the time, to where I am now. Well, I'll just cook with nothing but chickpeas, and chickpeas have as much protein as a steak, and it's low carbohydrates. They're fantastic. That Men's Health cover I did was all chickpeas. To get from here to there, that they need that stepping stone, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. And I think for me, it was two things. It was one, providing that stepping stone, which I experienced myself in going vegetarian and then vegan. And then secondly, you know, I'm a pretty healthy eater. Like, I shop at the local farmers markets up on the Sunshine Coast and, yeah, do a lot of my own cooking. My ISO sourdough is down pat, brew some kombucha at home. And I eat a pretty minimally processed whole food-based diet. So I wanted to do two things. So one, provide a transition food for people. And then two, develop a product that kind of aligned with that whole food diet. So something that was based on kind of minimally processed whole food ingredients and was actually really healthy for you.
Obviously, you're still kind of probably a bit rattled from the last business deconstructing yeah. itself in slow motion. At what point did you go, you know what, I'm going to go for it again?
Yeah, well, actually, the initial transition was, I was pretty rattled. Like, yeah, maybe, I don't know, some mild form of PTSD or something.
It's like a divorce. It's like everything. You lose the house. You lose the fucking, you have to find somewhere else to live. You got to create new bank accounts, like everything. You got to build the whole thing back together.
Yep. And yeah, 10 years of being focused on this, creating this thing, and then it didn't pan out. Yeah, so I didn't want to start another business, actually. Initially, I thought, no, I'll go work for somebody else. And I had gotten very passionate about the idea of wanting to help contribute to ending industrial animal agriculture. And I could see that the meat alternative path was, I thought, one of the best ways I could help contribute to that. So I tried to get a job with other meat alternative companies. My wife and I wanted to move back to Australia with our young kids. Got two young ones now. And so came back to Australia. And sort of, this was 3 years ago, I talked to all the meat alternative companies, but they were all literally one or two person operations 3 years ago. And, you know, maybe if I'd been a food scientist, there might have been jobs, but no one had a role for a washed up entrepreneur. So I then did some interviews with companies like Facebook and talked to Google and places like that. And I was in this really tough spot. Like, the idea of starting a business again made me feel physically ill. And then the idea of going and working at in a space that I just wasn't passionate about this time around also made me feel physically ill, and literally physically ill. So I managed to convince myself, okay, have a go at starting a meat alternative business. In doing that, you're going to meet everyone else in the industry who you've not already met, and, you know, maybe a job comes up, and at least you've left your options open. If the business goes well, you can focus on doing that. And if it doesn't, you'll have met everyone else and hopefully a job will come up. So that's how I kind of convinced my brain to
I'm all about tricking, you know. Part of us is, you know, this really high functioning, thinking, considerate person. Another part of us is literally a Labrador waiting for a kitchen scrap. If you just trick it, it'll just go and do a thing that you want it to do, and then it'll be eating the kitchen scrap and not realize that it's moved from one room to the other room where you wanted it to go. You can trick yourself into doing all kinds of stuff.
And they're literally physically different parts of your brain. In your brain, two things are physically two separate areas, and they compete in your
they
head.
Absolutely do. And if you know that you can trick the other one to doing something, and you don't let on, you're like, ha ha, fooled you. And the other part of the brain's like, ha ha, I'm doing something I want to do. It's brilliant. It's interesting to get there. Yeah. As you're putting this, you know, alternative meat thing together. I mean, we talked a little bit about, you know, working at Google, and when you're working at somewhere like that massive, you have access to ginormous amounts of data, and you can see these mega trends emerging. You know, you talked about wanting to end industrial animal agriculture. I'm sure people listening know enough about the problem that we're in as a human race. So much talk about fossil fuels, so much talk about, you know, manufacturing. Can you give us an idea of what the animal agriculture industry, besides the ethics of raising sentient beings for slaughter, besides that, what is the greenhouse gas emission factor of the animal agriculture industry in the climate emergency that we're in?
So like you say, there's in my mind, there's kind of four big reasons, which each on their own would be big enough reasons to end industrial animal agriculture. So one is health. The amount of meat that we eat is unhealthy. Another one is ethics, as you've touched on. Another one is pandemic prevention, which is even more important now we're going through COVID. And then as you've said and want to delve in on, the fourth one is sustainability. So to answer your question around sustainability, animal agriculture is responsible for 14.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions. It's actually more than all of transport combined. So we could electrify all the cars, planes, buses, ships, and that wouldn't have as much impact as if we stopped eating meat. And then the other, probably even bigger factor around sustainability is that 38.5% of the world's habitable landmass is devoted to animal agriculture. So I delved into why is that? And the issue is animals are an incredibly inefficient way to produce food. You know, the average cow needs to eat 12 kilograms of plants to produce 1 kilogram of beef. For a pig, it's 8 to 1. For a chicken, it's 4 to 1. And so 80% of the crops that we grow around the world aren't eaten by humans. They're eaten by animals, which humans then eat. So 80% of the world's crops are fed to animals, and we only get 18% of our calories from animals. So it's an incredibly inefficient way to produce food. And so if we switch to just eating those plants directly, we could reforest 38.5% of the world's habitable landmass. And not only would that completely, it would eliminate the 14.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions, but we could capture huge amounts of the carbon that we've emitted back in forests and rehabitat all of that land. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of things we need to do to prevent global warming sort of taking off. But in my mind, ending industrial animal agriculture is probably the biggest.
What you've just talked about there is that is the very reason that I stopped eating meat. When I found out, there's more than enough food for everybody, but we feed it to animals instead. Yeah. And there's more than enough water for everyone, but we use it for animals instead. Wait. People are hungry. Let's feed people the food that will make them just as healthy, build just as much muscle, get just as much mad gains. Once I learned that, that was the thing for me. That was this is so inefficient.
What were you reading 20 years ago to read that? That's impressive that it was that long ago.
I was working at a radio station, and we used to have a thing where a guest DJ would show up. And like it was usually a teenage kid who would be a part of, you know, the night show. We would play countdowns. This is before the internet, all right? So you couldn't just hear a song, any song ever recorded at the flick of a button. You had to kind of call up and request a song, right? And so like it was often a teenage kid would show up and they would get on air and they would play some of their favorite songs. And that was every night this person would show up. And they often had a parent with them. And it was this kid and their mum who was kind of a California-y kind of hippie kind of type. She was quite intense. Probably one of the people who would have put up the posters I was postering over at the university. She was that kind of person. Anyway, I was eating an Indian chicken curry in front of her. And that's when she said to me, I don't know if you realize this, but this is how much land is being used to farm animals. And this is how much water is being used to farm animals. And she didn't even bring the ethics of it into it. And I just thought to myself, like, that makes absolutely no sense. Like if you were pitching a business idea to Mike Cannon-Brookes, and we're like, hey, Mike, here's how it's going to go. It's going to be brilliant. We are going to take, get this, we're going to take 12 kilograms of the thing that we're ultimately going to sell, and we're going to use that to make 1 kilogram of the thing we're going to sell. You in? Go to the moon, baby. Like what investor would go, great idea, Michael, I'm in. Like fucking nobody. It's so extraordinarily inefficient, but we have this... You know, it's like we are tied to the oomph that our car gives us when we hit the gas, which is why we're afraid of electric cars. You've never driven a Tesla Model S on ludicrous speed. It'll scare the shit out of you. So similarly, we're also tied. My grandmother's svechka, the incredible Czech dish she used to make out of, you know, which reminded me of a warm winter's night, huggled and, you know, surrounded by family. We have this emotional connection to this food. How are you able to... With your product design, how are you able to get into that little niche there and try to tick those boxes for people without it being meat?
Yeah. So my co-founder in the business, Jim Fuller, he grew up in Texas eating all those kind of delicious slow-cooked meats, pulled pork, braised beef, beef brisket. And then he'd worked as a fine dining chef for 12 years and then worked as a mushroom scientist for the last 10 years. He went vegan for a year about 4 years ago. And during that year that he was vegan, he went back to Texas. He lives in Australia now. He went back to Texas And he just he experienced that whole emotional thing around, you know, he was going to barbecues and they were cooking all these meats and they were the meats that he'd grown up with. And he had this emotional crisis while he was over there. And so he came back to Australia and he's like, I know that I shouldn't be eating meat, but how do I solve this for myself? And so because he was a fine dining chef and a mushroom scientist, he's like, well, why don't I take mushrooms and try to recreate these things and give myself that emotional experience from mushrooms? And so he started doing that and just making these products for mushroom-based meat alternatives for himself to fill that emotional void that he was missing. And yeah, from his perspective, that's how he got into Fable and what we're doing.
My wife, Audrey, she makes the most extraordinary things with it. She makes briskets, she makes slow-baked stuff, she makes stuff in the pressure cooker with it. It's such a variable thing. I bought this stuff well before I even knew you were coming on the podcast. And when someone said, hey, do you want to talk to Michael? I'm like, yeah, I want to talk to that guy. I eat that stuff every week. How important was it to you to get that mouth feel right, to get that chewiness right, to get the only time I don't like Fable is when I'm digging bits of it out of my teeth with dental floss. But that's got to be part of the product design, right?
Right, right. That's part of the experience of eating those types of meat. Yeah, I mean, for Jim, it was genuinely an emotional thing. He needed to fill that void, so he was producing the products to fill that emotional void. You know, I came at it from the business perspective and the consumer research perspective, and as you've touched on, how do we create a product that helps people, that is, you know, the ladder up to the trampoline, that helps people transition over to plant-based foods? And to do that, we need to get, you know, reasonably close to replicating the taste and texture of meat. And then how can we do that with mushrooms and all natural ingredients?
Tell me about you talked about, you know, obviously animal agriculture is not the only kind of agriculture we have. There is monocropping agriculture, which is really efficient. It's got us as humans to this incredibly reliable food source where calories are no longer scarce. We can do all kinds of things. And we've managed to catapult ourselves forward with this. But there's some methods of food agriculture that are incredibly damaging as well. Obviously, you need a lot of mushrooms, a lot of shiitake mushrooms. Tell me about that factor. Did you have to look into that and ways that you could tick all your boxes as well as be guaranteed of a decent supply of these sometimes tricky to grow organisms?
Yeah, so regenerative agriculture and biodynamic agriculture is an area that I'm very passionate about and really interests me. My wife and I bought a 41-acre property recently on the Sunshine Coast, and some friends live on here with us who previously ran a regenerative farm. So we've got some veggie garden beds in, we're planting fruit trees, and we're actually kind of doing a lot of that stuff sort of personally on our property. Actually, we've got a lot of edible mushrooms that just grow naturally in the wild on the property too, which is awesome. So I'm personally very passionate about that
space.
Be
careful of some of the mushrooms in that part of the world. The guy that told me about Chen Rezig said he ate one on a bushwalk, and let's just say his gomper was pretty interesting that day.
It helps to have a mycologist as a business partner.
You take a photo and go, hey, Jim, should I eat this? Nope, don't eat that. Unless you've got really like the Grateful Dead, don't eat that.
Exactly. Jim gets a lot of weird photos of mushrooms sent to him with a lot of questions. Poor Jim.
But on the industrial, like you're obviously trying to source shiitake mushrooms at an industrial scale. How do you...
So that's it. Yeah, exactly. So I'm personally very passionate about regenerative agriculture, but meat is a $2 trillion industry. It's 2% of global GDP. It's massive. And for us to make a dent on that and have a big impact, we couldn't use the mushrooms that grow on our property, because if we're out foraging for those, and actually your producer Rachel came out foraging with us earlier this year when we ran some foraging tours in the Southern Highlands. And but those mushrooms, we can't, obviously we're not going to be able to put a dent in animal agriculture using mushrooms we pick in the forest. So when we were developing the products, we were looking at, okay, what are the mushrooms that are, you know, grown at scale? And so there's really two main ones. There's shiitake mushrooms, which are the most commonly grown mushrooms and commonly eaten mushrooms in Asia. And they've been grown for about 3,000 years in Asia agriculturally. And then there's agaricus mushrooms, which are more popular in European countries. And those are kind of the white button mushrooms we buy in Coles and Woolies. And those mushrooms started to be cultivated in France about 1,500 years ago. So these two species of mushrooms, shiitake and agaricus, have got a long history of use. They're incredibly healthy. Shiitake mushrooms have been used in traditional Chinese medicine for thousands of years. And there are reasonably big quantities of these mushrooms grown around the world. So we narrowed in and focused our development on those two species of mushrooms. And our pulled meaty mushrooms, which is the one that you've been eating, uses shiitake mushrooms. They're a slower growing mushroom. They grow on wooden logs that are actually made from kind of sawdust byproducts from the timber industry. So those get compressed into logs and then inoculated with the shiitake mushroom spores and mycelium, and then they grow the mushrooms indoors on those logs. So they're also a very efficient way of producing food. And then the sawdust logs, after they've grown four or five flushes of the mushrooms, it's a great way of composting the sawdust. And then that's kind of really good soil, really good compost that can then go onto farms. So yeah, the mushrooms don't use much water. They don't use much space to grow. They're grown indoors. They're composting the sawdust and the soil. And yeah, that's what we use predominantly for our products. And then our meaty mushroom burger, which we just launched into grilled. And that's our second product that uses shiitake and uses some agaricus mushroom as well.
Is that gluten-free? Because that's where I get my Beyond Burgers every week.
It is, yeah, yep, yep.
I'm so going to order one.
It's gluten-free.
Because I always have a weights out the back, and I always do extra heavy squats and I do extra reps on Fridays because Friday's burger night. And I always make sure I earn that burger. So I can't wait. I can't wait for Friday. That's going to be amazing. So now you've stumbled upon this thing. Like, if there's one thing I've learned in the last year and a half or so about talking to people about global warming, climate change, this terrifying apocalyptic chain reaction that we are already in, it's pretty scary if you start talking about how frightening it all is. You mentioned the size of the market. What's the upside? What have we got to look forward to by transitioning away from animal agriculture? What have we got to look forward to? And can you give us an idea of how big alternative meats are going to be? Because you've probably seen a few indicators that this is where things are going. Can you paint us a picture of the next 10, 20 years of alternative meats?
Yeah, so I honestly believe in 20 years' time, we're going to look back at eating meat from animals in a way that's analogous to how we look back at slavery. You know, it's obviously very different, but we're going to look back at it and be like shocked. That might take more than 20 years to get to that point. But I think our grandchildren, at least, are going to look back at the way that we eat meat and just be shocked and horrified by it. And the reason that change is going to happen is it certainly helps that there's vegans, vegetarians, and flexitarians, the people who want to reduce their meat consumption. And it's those flexitarians that we're targeting now. So people who listen to your podcast and understand the reasons why they should reduce their meat consumption. And so, you know, when they go to grilled, they pick a plant-based burger instead of a meat burger, or they're cutting back on their meat consumption. But the real way to change the market is simply to beat meat from animals on taste and price. So you go into Woolworths or Coles and you look at what's on special on the islands. It's corn chips, it's Coca-Cola, it's Oreos, it's products that are the cheaper on, they're on special and people like them. They taste great. People buy food on taste and price. So we need to beat meat on taste and price. And the great thing is that's actually not that difficult to do. If we start with price, as we've touched on, meat from animals is incredibly inefficient way to produce food. And so it's an incredibly expensive way to produce food. So that's why, you know, meat is more expensive than a can of chickpeas or other products in the supermarket, because it's so inefficient to produce. So our products, you know, we're still 2 years in, so we don't have the scale that the meat industry has, but we sell our products already at the same price as the equivalent animal meats. So Coles has a 250-gram pack of pulled pork and pulled beef that they sell for $7.50. Our product in Coles is a 250-gram pack of meaty pulled mushrooms that sells for $7.50. A 1 kilo pack, the distributors sell that for the same price as the cooked meat products. So even though we're not at scale yet, we're already matching the price of the animal meats that we're competing with. Actually, with grilled, we sell our burger patties to grilled for the same price that they buy their Wagyu beef burger patties, their premium burger patties. And grilled have actually done a great thing and put the price of our burgers are actually even a little bit cheaper than their Wagyu beef burgers, because they want to also, you know, they're good. They also want to encourage people to move to being plant-based diets. So we're going to win on price. Give us another 2-3 years with some more scale, we're going to be 20-30% cheaper than meat. So then if you're buying meat, you're actually having to think about, oh, do I want to pay more for this animal meat product than I would for the fable product? So we're going to win on price very quickly. And then so the other thing is taste and texture. And there's different approaches to this within the meat alternative space, and it's great that there are companies taking different approaches. So Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods, which you've touched on, their approach is they want to replicate the taste and texture of meat exactly. They want the burger patty to be red before you cook it, turns brown when you cook it. They want it to bleed like a meat patty. They want to just replicate it exactly. And that's a really great approach, and that works for some segments of the market. Our approach is we just want to make delicious, meaty food from mushrooms. So we're not necessarily trying to replicate meat exactly. We want you to have that same emotional experience that you have when you're eating a meat product. But we celebrate the fact our product's made from mushrooms. We use all whole food natural ingredients. And we just want to make delicious, meaty food from mushrooms and, yeah, celebrate that that's what it is.
For people that lift weights and stuff, how does it compare nutritionally?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting question. So obviously, if you're doing a lot of lifting of weights, then you need a fair amount of protein in your diet. 97% of Australians get enough protein in their diet. Less than 10% of Australians get enough fiber in their diet. Literally less than 10% of Australians eat enough fiber. So when we think about health, we often think about protein as being the thing that we're deficient in, but it's not. Most of us are deficient in fiber. And the issue is, animal meat has no fiber in it, like literally no fiber. And because we're eating, each Australian's eating 122 kilograms of land animals every year, we're not getting enough fiber. If you eat a plant-based diet, your risk of getting bowel cancer is almost zero. And it's the third biggest killer in Australia. You know, heart disease is strong correlations between red meat and heart disease. That's the biggest killer in Australia. So eating more fiber in your diet is one of the biggest changes we could make on a societal level to improve our health. Mushrooms are incredibly high in fiber. They're a really good source of fiber. And so are basically all plant-based foods. And mushrooms have been used in traditional Chinese medicine for thousands of years. A whole bunch of Western science has caught up with all of that too. They're great sources of vitamin D, great sources of B vitamins, which you can sometimes not get enough of in a plant-based diet. So yeah, mushrooms are great.
Just a quick moment away from Michael Fox to let you know about an episode that was actually just a few weeks back, and it's with one of Fable's investors, Mike Cannon-Brooks. Yeah, not only did they, Atlassian, create, you know, incredibly powerful business tools and, you know, the 100-something billion-dollar company. And not only is Mike interested in building huge solar farms, he's also interested in meat alternatives, because that's a big part of the climate solution. And there's a great chat on this podcast, episode 397. And that conversation tackles, I guess, a broader look at how we as a country stand to be absolute winners if we play climate adaptation and climate action the right way. Here's just a little taste.
Industries rise and fall. We're well adapted to it as a society, and we should manage that rise and manage that fall. But as the fossil fuel industry peters away, the challenge that economies and countries have is they don't have something to replace it. We are so lucky that we have an amazing opportunity to replace it with something even bigger, if we could just kind of grab it and figure out the levers to actually get people to understand it. We have incredible renewable resources, sun, wind. Well, we have a lot of wind due to the Indian Ocean. We're in a very lucky place on the planet, kind of the way the planetary winds work. We have a lot of sun that falls on our country that's very consistent, and we have a lot of space with nothing in it. That's largely what you need for solar panels, right? I would point out my day job at Atlassian. I'm a manufacturer and an exporter. We manufacture stuff and we export it, just like Australian industries classically always have. The total value of that boggles the mind at the size and impact it could have on the Australian economy. Man, we just got to go do it.
All right, that's episode 397 with Mike Cannon-Brooks. You can find it in this podcast feed. Just scroll on back and find it there. You might hear an ad here. If you do, thank you. If not, we'll get right back to our chat with Michael.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When you go to work every day doing this, you said you were doing jobs that made you feel physically ill, or the prospect of doing jobs made you feel physically ill. How do you feel putting your time and effort, time away from your kids playing Lego on the floor? How do you feel working on this?
It is honestly just a privilege to be able to work on what, in my view, is the thing that we could be doing to have the biggest impact on, you know, humanity's future, biggest positive impact on humanity's future. It took me a long time to get to that place, to be able to work in this space. But yeah, I love it. And actually, I had a really moving moment yesterday. Went and picked up my four-year-old from daycare, and Father's Day is coming up, so they've got these little write-ups that they've done. And I think the third line on his little write-up was, "Daddy's job is fable. He helps people not have to eat animals." And just seeing, you know, my four-year-old has picked that up, and that he sees that that's what I'm doing as a job. That was a really emotional moment for me.
Is it better for your mental health working on something that you truly believe in your core and is in alignment with your values?
1,000 times yes to that answer. It's actually a fascinating experience. I don't think I didn't. You obviously had discovered your values and things a little bit earlier in your life. It took me, I think it took me a bit longer. Yeah, when I finished university, as we touched on, you know, I really had no idea what I wanted to do. And then when it came to starting a shoe business, Shoes of Prey, I was thinking just purely from a, you know, where is there a gap in the market and where is there an entrepreneurial opportunity? You know, I didn't have a particular passion for women's shoes. I loved retail and I loved technology. And so the idea of doing a custom women's shoe online retail business excited me, but it was really, you know, it was capitalism at its finest, you know, looking for the gap in the market and then creating a product to fill that gap. And then I went vegetarian whilst I was doing that business and had the realization, we sell all these leather shoes. I like, okay, everyone, we've got to do a vegan shoe line within Shoes of Prey because I feel terrible about this. So we launched a vegan shoe line and, you know, we got maybe 10 or 15% of our sales over to vegan shoe leather. But I felt like if our sales go up, you know, this didn't stop me from trying to make the business a success, but I'd go to work and I had this conflict. If our sales go up, I'm actually selling more animal products and more leather. So I had this kind of internal conflict. And it wasn't enough to make me quit doing Shoes of Prey, not at all. You know, it really took until the business ended up not working out for other reasons that I then took 6 months off and spent time really exploring, okay, I have now realized I want to work on something that I'm passionate about and love. Firstly, what is that? And secondly, how do I go about creating a job or being able to work in that space? So being there now in the place where I've done that is, yeah, it's a real thrill.
Mate, I'm so grateful to have your time today. Thank you so much. It's been really great to connect with you. Enjoy your beautiful part of the world for me. I can see you're wearing a jumper, so it's probably only 24 degrees up there today. So,
I did have a swim in the ocean yesterday.
Yeah, you did.
It is nice and warm.
Queensland. Oh, well, one of these days I'll get back to my home country. Have a great day. Enjoy your garden beds. It's been brilliant to talk to you, man. Thanks so much for your time, Michael.
Thanks so much.
And ladies and gentlemen, that was Michael Fox. You can find him on Twitter. He's MM Michael Fox. So like triple M and then Eichel Fox. Or one word. And he can have a look at what they're making at fablefood.co. He's a great bloke. And I think there's a lot of growth ahead of them. Pun intended. I'm very excited for them. Thanks heaps for listening. I really appreciate it. There's hundreds of other episodes to go and check out. If this is your first time, thanks for being a part of it. If you want to get into a few episodes, but you don't know where to start as far as interviews go, just check out some Friday episodes for a while, and that might get you in the swing of things before you get into some of the interview episodes. You can still catch the documentary on SBS On Demand. Just go to sbs.com.au and look up Australia Uncovered, where the second episode is called A Matter of Life and Death. Thanks so much for being a part of the show. Thanks, Michael, for being here. I'll see you on Friday. And a massive, massive thank you to everyone that helped me make this show, which includes Andy Ma, my audio producer, Rachel Barrett, my executive producer, and Bree Steele on research. I'm going to go upstairs and have a nap. That's right, I am. It's my weekly nap. I'm very excited about it. Until we speak next time, sleep well and dream of beautiful things.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.